Hello and welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Truro, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people, who are known today as the Stockbridge Muncie community. And I'm Kaelin McPherson.
I'm Sina Pseedlahickey. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with Mark Dunley sharing information on local efforts on March 23rd as part of a National Day of Action to tell banks to stop financing fossil fuels. Then we hear of five classic books in the field of speculative fiction and the start of the cyberpunk genre with Bria Barthel. Later on, Eunice Jung gives us perspective on fat phobia in the medical field and how that can create barriers to proper health for healthcare for patients. After that, Dave Ohl tells us about contact improv and the benefits for communication and self-reflection. Finally, Taina Asili brings us another profile in her The Rhythm of Rebellion series, this time with Jimena Violante, a Mexican musician, educator, and more. But first, here are the headlines.
On Tuesday, March 21st, Coxsackie residents will choose between incumbent Republican Mark Edwards and Democrat Veronica Foley in the village race for mayor. At this center of the race is controversial how a boutique hotel will be built on village waterfront. Affordable housing is another key issue.
The union CSEA has filed a complaint of improper labor practice against Saratoga Springs after the city's commissioner of accounts fired the assistant assessor and then hired a more costly outside firm to assess city properties.
The Gazette reports that the enrollment across the State University of New York system continued to fall last semester, but area community colleges saw enrollment remain either flat or increase slightly following years of decline.
The state will make it easier to make last-minute reservations to camp at its campgrounds this summer. Campers will now be able to reserve a campsite at as late as 5 p.m., on their date of arrival at DEC's 52 campgrounds. And that's it for headlines.
For those just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, listener-supported radio that builds community in Troy and the surrounding capital region through broad grassroots participation.
Our content is produced by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or call 518-272-2390.
Now to our first story. On Tuesday, March 23rd is a National Day of Action to tell banks to stop financing fossil fuels. Mark Dunley brings us this information on what action will be taken in Albany as part of this effort.
We're joined by Reverend John Paulberg, who is a former retired pastor from Reformed Church of America, and is also on the Executive Committee of New York State Council of Churches. And a lot of groups, including the Rivers and Mountains Green Faith, is joining as part of this Third Act, Bill McKibben's group, Day of Action on Tuesday, March 21st, about basically trying to get the banks to stop funding fossil fuels. Is going to start at noon on Broadway by the walkway there to the Corner Reserve. So, John, maybe explain just what, you know, why is this National Day of Action, you know, being called, and why are faith groups mobilizing?
Yeah, the Day of Action is focusing on four large banks, Bank of America, Chase, Wells Fargo, and Citibank. They are the four biggest lenders in the world to the fossil fuel industry. And we're calling on banks not to totally divest from fossil fuels, but to refrain from expanding fossil fuel projects, to make no more loans for new projects. And people of faith are involved because it's a moral issue.
Back in 2015 or so, you know, that we had this international gathering in Paris to hammer out climate accords among all the countries on the planet, and, you know, generally agreement that we had to stop, you know, using fossil fuels, some disagreement over about how fast to do it. But have the banks, you know, been backing out of financing fossil fuels since the Paris Climate Accords?
They've certainly not reduced in the 6 years following the Paris Accords. In 2016 to 2021, Chase invested more than $382 billion in fossil fuel projects and companies. And over $100 billion of that went to companies who are expanding fossil fuel infrastructure. So they need to change what they're doing and at least stop financing new projects.
Now, I mentioned this is going to be on Tuesday, March 21st at noon. It's going to start at the, Maiden Lane and Broadway in downtown Albany at noon. So can you walk us through what's going to happen with this event?
We will be going to each of three banks, Bank of America, Chase, and Wells Fargo. There'll be representatives of youth and members of the faith community from several different traditions, and people from the frontline communities who will be affected most by climate change. We'll be making brief presentations at each of the banks and then delivering a letter asking these banks to stop financing new fossil fuel projects.
And I understand this is a national day of action. I think I heard as many of, you know, eight other events are taking place in New York alone. So it seems like a lot of groups are really getting behind this day.
Yeah, there's some 90 demonstrations across the country on Tuesday.
And what can individuals, you know, say, listening to this show and, you know, boy, I don't want, you know, my money, going to, you know, finance fossil fuels that are destroying life on the planet. What can individuals do at this point to support this effort?
Well, check your credit cards. If you have credit cards financed by Bank of America or Chase or Citibank, you can cut them up and find another credit card. If you have checking accounts or savings accounts with these banks, you can move your money to a different bank. And you can certainly, you know, contact your bank and let them know why you're concerned, that this is indeed a moral issue, and for, especially for people of faith who believe that we ought to love God and love our neighbors as ourselves. It's clear that continuing use of fossil fuels is harming the planet and harming people, our neighbors, and we can make changes.
Now, I remember during the protests against Vietnam War, one thing that young men used to do was to cut up their draft cards. Is going to be any cutting up of credit cards at this protest?
I don't know that we're doing that in Albany, but I know that many of the other demonstrations that will be part of the action on Tuesday. And indeed, many have already done this, cut up their credit cards and move their money out of these banks.
Now, you're part of the New York State Council of Churches, and I mean, there are dozens of groups that are co-sponsoring this rally, but particularly, you know, the churches and other faith groups, you know, what has the faith community been doing in the overall climate movement to make their voices heard?
Many people in the church and other faith communities have been working on this issue for decades. We started in the Reformed Church, I know, working on it in the 90s. And many faith groups have already divested from the fossil fuel industry. Worldwide, some $40 trillion have been divested from endowment funds, you know, by churches, by educational institutions. And we need to do more to call attention to this issue, so that more will join us in making sure as much as possible that our dollars and investments aren't being used to harm the planet.
So I understand it's going to be maybe a little bit short, a couple speeches, and then people are going to march to these different banks. I assume you want people to join in. How best can they get more information? And any idea about how long the event's going to be taking place?
One way to find out more information, both about the national movement and the specific one in Albany, is go to the website, thirdact.org, and you'll find information there. There'll be brief speeches at each of the three banks that we're visiting, and then delivery of the letter. I imagine it's going to begin at noon. I imagine that it will not last more than, 90 minutes, 2 hours at most, I would think, probably closer to 90 minutes.
How do the banks, justify their continuing, investment in fossil fuels after it's very clear that, the government's position is we need to stop using these fossil fuels?
Yeah, I don't know how they justify it. It's one thing to say we can't transition, to renewable energy 100% overnight, but to continue to invest in the expansion of fossil fuel projects, I don't think that's morally defensible, and probably not necessary. We need to move more quickly toward renewables.
Just switching gears maybe a little bit in the last minute or so, I know that the Council of Churches have been active at the state level with coalitions like New York Renews on climate issues. Are there, with the state budget coming up, is there anything particularly the Council of Churches particularly hoping happens on climate at the New York level?
There are several bills before the Assembly and the Senate. The Climate Change Superfund Act, we're supporting that. Another important piece of legislation is the All Electric Building Act, which would move us away from using fossil fuels, eventually toward using renewable energy, renewable electricity.
Okay. Well, we want to thank Reverend John Paulberg for joining us today, Tuesday, March 21st at noon. Stop Dirty Banks, Stop Funding the Climate Chaos, going to start at Maiden Lane and Broadway at noon. Rivers and Mountain Green Faith and dozens of other groups. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Once again, that march as part of the National Day of Action to tell banks to stop financing fossil fuels will start on Tuesday, March 23rd at noon at the corner of Maiden Lane and Broadway.
In our next segment, you will hear about the field of speculative fiction and its subgenre of cyberpunk fiction, and what this is about the CIA collaborating with the Library of Congress.
Hi, this is Bria Barthel for Hudson Mohawk Magazine, and I'm back once again at the Lansingburg branch of Troy Public Library to talk with the branch manager, Lori Dreyer, who now is also outreach manager for all of Troy Public Library. So she's reaching out to us with some books of speculative fiction. Lori, take it away.
Hi, Bria. It's so nice to talk to you again. It's been a while. I am really excited about my list today. I'm a big science fiction person, and I don't know if folks know the name speculative fiction, but it's basically another term that means science fiction books. It's kind of a wide genre. And of course, then you can break it down into smaller categories. But this is mainly focused on general science fiction, and specifically that of the 1990s. So I just finished reading The Parable of the Sower by Octavia E. Butler, a classic, an absolute classic of science fiction. I had never read it before, and I loved it. And it absolutely holds up despite having been published in 1993. So I'll give you a little synopsis. Lauren is a teenager In a post-apocalyptic Los Angeles, she is the oldest of her siblings and is gifted in teaching and writing. Her family has survived together in a small conclave with 11 other households who live behind walls, and they weaponize themselves, they prepare themselves for the hordes outside their walls. More and more, as the book goes on, thieves are breaking into the conclave and stealing and sometimes harming the residents of the village. And Lauren knows that there is more to life than just survival and starts a crusade to explore new ways of living. So I recommend this book for folks who have enjoyed Hilary Mantel, Margaret Atwood, the epic books of Stephen King. This is the first in an unfinished trilogy. Butler wrote the second book in the trilogy. I believe she then wrote a prequel, but she never was able to finish it before her death in 2005, unfortunately.
And this is the book I think you mentioned before we started recording that it's set in 2024?
It is. The book starts out in 2024, and by the end of the book, I believe it is the year 2027. And it's fascinating to see what Butler thought would be happening during that time. It's obviously post-apocalyptic, so it's very dark, but it's also there are a lot of rays of hope. And it's very much about relationships and having faith in one another. And it's really an excellent book.
Given the last couple of years, it's sort of hopeful to be post-apocalyptic rather than just apocalyptic. And the next book?
So after reading this book, I kind of got more interested in the idea of classic science fiction, and I created a list for myself of four science fiction titles or series that I wanted to read, specifically from the 1990s, which was a really important time in science fiction. People don't really think about it. So the first one on this list, actually, I'm counting down, so this is the fourth one on the list, is called Beggars in Spain by Nancy Kress. The book, originally published as a novella, is the first book of a trilogy that explores class and what we owe to each other. Humans, particularly those in the U.S., now live in a world where genetic engineering is commonplace and has led to some humans called sleepless because they are ultra productive and have no need for sleep.
Do they live in Seattle, perhaps?
That's cute. I didn't even think of that. So of the sleepers, you know, the people who live outside of Seattle, the question becomes, how can one be most productive? But when productivity is the sole purpose of your life, how are people who are less productive experiencing those lives? And how does that affect the larger community and the future of humans? So brings up a lot of really interesting questions, as science fiction tends to. And so I'm looking forward to experiencing that myself.
And the name of that book again is?
That was Beggars in Spain by Nancy Kress.
Great. And next up?
Number three on my list is The Difference Engine by Bruce Sterling and William Gibson. Now, William Gibson, you may be familiar with. He's pretty well known in the science fiction author circuit. And one of his books was recently turned into a show on Amazon Prime called The Peripheral, which was a really excellent show. So this book he wrote with Bruce Sterling, who's also a science fiction writer. Sterling has some serious sci-fi chops and has won two Hugo Awards during the 1990s. So together, Sterling and Gibson are known for being some of the founders of the cyberpunk genre of science fiction. The Difference Engine is an alternative history novel that essentially launched the cyberpunk genre. The book mostly takes place in 1855, but in this version of 1855, Charles Babbage, often credited with building the first computer, with his partner Ada Lovelace. Now, Ada Lovelace was not mentioned in any of the reviews I read for this book, but I wanted to make sure her name was out there. So Charles Babbage has invented his analytical engine and taken up political office. So very different than actual history. But because of the success of his engine, both Babbage and the UK, the United Kingdom, are more powerful, creating a fascinating alternative to recorded history. it might sound like this is kind of goes into more of a steampunk genre. And indeed, this book has contributed a lot to steampunk culture online, mostly. But it started the cyberpunk genre of science fiction, which has now become huge.
Sounds very interesting. I maybe off recorder, I'll ask you the difference between cyberpunk and steampunk, but I don't think we have time to explore it now. Next up.
It's a pretty minimal difference, I think. All right. So number two on my list is The Giver by Lois Lowry, which I'm sure that a lot of you already know. It's a Newbery Award winner. And it is voted, it has been voted the fourth best children's novel of all time, more than once. So The Giver takes place in a society where there exists no pain or strife, mostly through the adoption of sameness, this concept of sameness. Jonas is a 12-year-old boy who's been chosen as the new receiver of memory, the person who stores all the past memories of the time before sameness. In this new world with little or to no emotional depth, I mean, you have to think about it, like if everybody's the same, there's no emotion happening. So Jonas has to figure out how to live with having emotions in a world like that and feelings related to all the memories that he holds of humanity. So this book, again, is a classic, another classic of science fiction. And shockingly, I've never read it, but I've always heard that it was a wonderful, wonderful book.
Great. And
there's one more. So number one is Snow Crash by Neal Stephenson. And now Brea mentioned she doesn't know Neal Stephenson. He is also a well-known science fiction author, classic science fiction author. And so this book takes you back to post-apocalyptic Los Angeles, because who doesn't love post-apocalyptic Los Angeles? This time, though, privatization has run rampant, and much of the world is split into enclaves run by various businesses or pseudo-businesses, such as the American Mafia Enclave. The federal government exists only in certain places, and most services formerly provided by the government are now hired out, including mail delivery. The main character of the book, whose name is Hero, protagonist, yes, you heard that right, his name is Hero, protagonist, helps out a young skateboard courier, and they strike up a friendship, later selling information to the CIC, a merger of the former CIA and the Library of Congress, which is the part that really intrigues me. I mean, how does the CIA merge with the Library of... I want to read this. I want to know how that works.
I guess they're both research-based, maybe?
I guess. Oh, I hate to think of libraries starting to spy on people. My goodness. No, no, no. So let's see. Much of the action of this book takes place in the metaverse, a term coined by Stevenson to describe a virtual reality similar to that of a modern-day MMO space. Again, here we are seeing the dawn of cyberpunk novel come into shape, and we're seeing a lot of really accurate, eerily accurate, in fact, future prediction.
Thanks. That was Lori Dreyer from the Lansingburg branch of the Troy Public Library, bringing you post-apocalyptic tales and cyberpunk and all sorts of cheery things. And if people want more information about these books or some of the cool activities you have coming up in Lansingburg and at the main branch, how do they find out?
Everything is listed on our website, and the address is www.thetroylibrary.org.
Thanks so much, Lori. And this is Bria Barthel for Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Interesting to hear that the 1990s authors already conceived of the year 2024 as post-apocalyptic. Full list of those titles and authors are provided on our website along with this segment. And as you just heard, Troy, the Troy Public Library, has more information on the rest.
For those just tuning in, I'm Kalen McPherson.
I'm Sina Bazila Hickey. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOGLP 92.7 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, and WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, also streaming online at mediasanctuary.org. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
If you like what you hear, you can support this program by telling a friend. Find today's stories and more at mediasanctuary.org.
Next, we get a look at the impact of the fatphobic views of some healthcare professionals and the effects that they have on the experience of their patients.
This is Eunice Jung, and today I'm talking to KP. Welcome, KP. Can you start the conversation about your medical journey regarding maternity and your experience with fat phobia in the medical field?
Sure. So I am a mother of two, and I, you know, had children somewhat young, you know, pretty much fully healthy adult, no chronic medical issues, you know, no real concerns. But found sort of as soon as I got into this process of, you know, needing maternity care, that the focus on my weight became a central issue and was almost constantly brought up by healthcare providers as something that would present a challenge for me and could present challenges and harm to my, you know, then unborn children. And so I think, you know, certainly as someone who has always been a heavier person, I have always been questioned or reminded that, you know, watching my weight and maintaining a healthy lifestyle and diet was important. But it felt like when I ventured into maternity care, that became a huge focus of almost every doctor visit that I had throughout both of my pregnancies.
Was there a connection between your maternity journey and the fat phobia you had to go through?
I think it definitely intensified, you know, in my maternity care experience. You know, like I said, I've always kind of been a bit of a heavier person. And so every doctor I've ever seen, you know, my annual physicals for school as a young person, it was always a topic of conversation that watching my weight, maintaining a healthy lifestyle was going to be important for me to avoid medical issues. But it felt like when I entered into that world of maternity care and where people were talking about, you know, preparing for having children and making sure that I had a healthy pregnancy, all of a sudden my weight became this very central topic. And it was almost like there was a fear put into me about gaining weight during pregnancy. You know, you always see on TV like pregnant women portrayed as just eating for two or being able to kind of indulge in things that they wouldn't normally indulge in. But as a heavier person, I actually found that was not encouraged. And that it was almost like I was trying to be scared out of like falling into that trope of pregnant women, you know, overeating or overindulging because I was already a heavier person. And it just sort of wove its way through all of my doctor visits. And it made me, you know, really kind of have a hesitancy with like opening up and having really honest and clear communication with my healthcare providers, because I felt like if I ever brought up, you know, something that I was concerned about or felt like maybe wasn't going well, that it was going to be attributed to the fact that I was a heavier person and somehow linked to a behavior that I was engaging in that wasn't good for me or for my baby. And so it was really anxiety inducing in a way that I hadn't felt before.
So would you say that the emotional damage that you had to go through intensified after your interactions with doctors and their responses?
I don't know if I was damaged by it because I put up a wall almost immediately, you know, with one healthcare provider in particular, who I saw regularly throughout my pregnancies. And it was like, if I was seeing that provider, the visit was usually much shorter. I didn't ask a lot of questions. I didn't really engage a lot because I felt like the topic was always going to come around to my weight and how that played into the health of me and my children. You know, I think it it bears mentioning that, although, like I said, I have always been a heavier person, that I've never had any of the, you know, sort of chronic illnesses or ailments that are generally attributed to being overweight or obese. You know, never had any issues with blood sugar or blood pressure or, you know, any of these things. But yet that just always seemed to be this central focus of talking about my pregnancy journey and my experience. So, you know, for example, I had sciatica pretty badly with my first pregnancy. And I, you know, instead of turning to my healthcare provider, I went to, you know, my network of other mothers that I knew who had, you know, experienced this during pregnancy, and was asking them for advice instead of going to my healthcare provider, because I felt like my healthcare provider was going to tell me that I was having this issue because I was fat, you know? And so just, I wouldn't go so far as to say that there was like emotional damage, but just that my experience with my healthcare provider, my preparedness for labor and delivery was all really diminished because I didn't have a comfortable relationship with my provider. And I wasn't really asking all the questions that I had as a new mom to the person who I feel like really should have been central to, you know, the care team that was preparing me to give birth and to take on this, you know, new role of motherhood.
Yeah. How do you think it could be improved, or the response of the healthcare providers could be improved in the future? Or in the future, when you have to approach them for a similar incident, what would you be expecting them to be more like?
Well, I think it's sort of a symptom of how we do healthcare here that, you know, many people are often subject to find providers that fit within whatever support they have for healthcare. So if that's whatever providers are local to them that they can access by transportation, whatever providers are, you know, participants in their medical insurance. And so, you know, certainly for me in my experience, that resulted in having a different OB than I'd had for, you know, my primary gynecological care prior to becoming pregnant. You know, it wasn't my primary care doctor. It wasn't someone who had a long history with me as a patient. And so, you know, from the patient side of things, if I could speak to providers, you know, what I would say to them is really encouraging them to get to know their patients better in a more holistic way, and not just looking at the number on the scale the first time that they come into the office or their physical appearance, but really getting an understanding of what is the family health history here, what is the personal health history here, and how is that going to impact pregnancy potentially. You know, and it's not to say that conversations about healthy diet and exercise and, you know, maintaining a good balance during pregnancy isn't important. It certainly should be part of the conversation, regardless of the body type or weight of the patient. But that when that becomes a central focus, it can be really triggering. It was for me, and really shut me down to communicating with the provider. So that would be something that I think could be improved, is just a more holistic look at who the patient is and what their history may tell, and then making informed decisions about how to advise patients, you know, through their maternity journey or their, you know, health journey in general.
Would you like to leave any last minute comment for those who may be empathizing with your experience right now?
What I would say to people is just that, yes, medical providers are, you know, highly knowledgeable and educated people, but we live in our bodies every day, and we really need to trust our own instincts about what type of care is best for us, and where we need to focus our energies, especially throughout the experience of pregnancy. It's such a huge responsibility to create new life, right? And that if that experience is sort of allowed to be infiltrated by these anxieties and external pressures from others, to be hyper conscious of your body and the way that it looks and the way that it functions, you know, that can really derail the enjoyment of the experience and the fullness of really being present in those moments and advocating for yourself. So I would just encourage people to listen to their own instincts in that way.
Well, thank you for a great ending at the interview today, KP.
Thanks for having me.
That was Hudson Mohawk correspondent Eunice Jong talking with a mother of two about her experiences with fat phobia from the medical industry.
Continuing on the theme of physical experience, we'll now have a look at the activities of contact improv. I spoke with Dave Ohl, the organizer of these jam sessions, which take place on the last Saturday of every month in Malta, New York. We're watching a video of a recent contact improv jam organized by Dave Ohl, who joins me now to tell us a little bit more about this practice. Welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine, Dave.
Thank you.
So listeners can't see what we're looking at. Can you describe what's going on here?
Yeah, this is a video of Heather and I, and we are basically just dancing improv style on a wooden floor. And right now Heather is in the quadruped position. I'm sort of arching over her, and now I'm on the ground. So yeah, this is contact improv, and we're basically just down on the floor and just sort of using each other as like props to like, you know, move off of and roll around on top of.
When you said you're dancing improv, and when... Mm-hmm. When you first brought up this to me, I was thinking standing a little bit more footwork, but that's not so much about the contact improv.
Right.
So as you mentioned, yeah, it's like lower to the floor. Where does this come from? How long has this been around?
This was, I guess, developed or started or invented in the early 70s by a group of New York City dancers and martial artists and gymnasts. And there are some really great videos of like early contact improv on YouTube, where they're actually using athletic mats and like jumping on top of one another. Mm. But this is much more slow and like flowing, I would say. So that's where it comes from.
How do you feel when you're doing this?
How do I feel? Usually I feel... usually if I'm dancing by myself, I'm just sort of flailing around or whatever, but this makes me like really listen to the other person that I'm dancing with and like to sensing their movements, sort of sensing how I feel about what's going on, noticing where my body is in space. And also like, so at some point I start to evaluate my own actions and thoughts, right, while I'm dancing. And that is an interesting point at which I feel like I can either remove myself from the dance and like consider what's happening, or like acknowledge that I'm thinking about all of this and I can put that aside and resume dancing, which I don't know if that makes any sense, but
well, what I'm
there's
hearing
a lot
is,
going on.
Yeah, there's a lot of communication that's involved in and introspective perception of communication.
Yeah.
Do people who get involved with contact improv, is it a way to work on communication and introspection?
Yeah, I think it really can be. I think that through contact improv, I think I've improved my nonverbal communicating skills. And this might be a deeper conversation, but there, I think that one can learn a lot about consent through contact improv. Learning how to notice when people are not interested in dancing without saying no, or you know, how to offer oneself as a dancing partner non-verbally, which can translate into other aspects of life. Yeah, did I answer the question?
Sounds to me like your answer is yes, it is a practice of communication. And how, what drew you to this in the first place? Where, how did you discover this?
Yeah, okay. I was invited to a jam back in like 2007 or 2008, maybe, by a friend of mine in Troy. There was a woman, Emma Willard, who was hosting jams, and I went to a few and enjoyed it, but for whatever reason, stopped going. And then I took some tango classes, and I spent like 6 or 7 months taking them, and I really didn't feel any improvement, and I was getting very frustrated, and so I stopped. And a few years later, a friend of mine I was depressed, and a friend of mine challenged me to find a hobby or two that I might spend some money on, you know, spend some resources, spend some time doing that I really wanted to do. And I knew that dance was one of them. And I guess I kind of just remembered the contact improv that I did. And I've also visited Earth Dance, which is a place in Western Massachusetts that specialized. It was founded by a bunch of contact improv dancers who moved up to Western Massachusetts from New York City. And so I went there I started going there regularly for jams, and that's how I got into it.
And now you're organizing jams.
Yeah.
How often are those taking place? Where are they? How can people get involved?
Right now they're once a month. They are at a small studio called Movement Insights in Malta, New York. It's very close to Exit 12 off the Northway. It's on the last Saturday of the month at 11 a.m.
We'll put ways to get involved in the description of this interview, well as with a link to the YouTube video to see an example of contact improv.
Cool.
So what if a listener is thinking, well, I'm not very comfortable with close contact with people who I don't know well, or just in general. Mm-hmm. We all have different comfort levels of our personal space. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. One of the, I guess, cardinal rules is that there's no wrong way to do contact improv, first of all. And there's also just a general guideline that the dance is totally voluntary, and you can leave the dance at any time. You can change your mind about dancing with whoever it is you're dancing with. There's no requirement to actually dance with anybody, so you can hang out in a corner and watch. That's actually often considered to be an important part of contact improv, is the sort of the audience. I think it's expected that participants are not just dancing, they're also observing and I guess spectating. And you can negotiate. Heather and I are also hosting, like before the jam, we also are having little mini classes where we maybe will introduce an aspect of contact improv, or we can introduce it in a way that's a little more friendly through a sort of a mini class. So you can dance contact improv just with hands. You know, you don't have to get down on the floor. You don't have to roll on people, or you can just dance with hands in the air standing. There's a lot of different ways to do it. You can also communicate to your dance partner that there are places that, you know, what you're comfortable with. Whatever your guideline is, like, I just want to use my hands right now, or I'm not comfortable getting on my knees or getting on the floor right now. So that's an important aspect too. Yeah.
What are some of the biggest questions that you get, and you say that you have classes. So what are some of the important elements to understand?
Usually the classes, we're trying to limit them to about half an hour in length. They are basic exercises to get people tuned in with their bodies and comfortable, to give them some guidance as to how to start. Because most people walk in and they're like, I don't know what to do. This is all new to me. And there's a number of different kinds of exercises, and they are focused on giving weight, accepting weight, maybe rolling, maybe noticing how, you know, what's the difference between a light touch and a hard touch, stuff like that.
Thank you so much, David Ohl, for telling us about Contact Improv Jam. What would you like to leave our listeners with?
So what it's done for me is it has really helped me think about my relationships with people and It's given me a way of noticing my own thoughts in a healthy way. It's given me a good way, like new nonverbal ways of connecting and communicating with other people. I think it has helped me socially by allowing me to sort of ease my way into conversations or social occasions that are going on. And it's also very fun, and it feels like it's also helped me with some of my musculoskeletal problems.
Musculoskeletal problems. Excellent.
Yeah. So that's a large topic, and I think that's a pretty good simplification of it, of how I feel like it's impacted me, and a good last message.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
As mentioned, the video that we're referencing at the beginning and ways to connect Dave and are in the description to this story on our website.
Finally, this week's segment of The Rhythm of Rebellion, Taina Esili profiles Mexican musician Ximena Violante.
Ximena Violante is a Mexican violinist, jarana player, singer, teacher, actor, and organizer, creating spaces for people to celebrate their roots, reimagine their futures, and expand their communities. Ximena is the bandleader and songwriter for Interminable, a futuristic fusion project that brings together son jarocho, an Afro-mestizo musical tradition from Mexico, with jazz, rock, and funk. Hello, Ximena. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm so grateful to have you here.
Hola, today. Hola. Muchas gracias por tenerme aquí. Thank you so much for having me on this.
I wanted to start by talking a little bit about your early history in music, because I'm really curious about what your early journey of music looks like, and you know what that looks like in general, and then also when did son jarocho come into your life?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm originally from Mexico City. I was born there, but then we moved up to the U.S. me and my parents when I was pretty young. And I was 7 years old at that time. And even from before then, I think I had just always been interested in learning an instrument. And so I had been kind of like pestering my parents, like, hey, can I play guitar? Can I play piano? And they were like, wait till you're older. And finally, when we were in the US, they were like, okay, fine, you can like, you know, you can save up your allowances. And like, we went and got a little keyboard from Radio Shack. And that's how I started. Just learning a little bit on my own. And then my school's orchestra program started and they were like, well, here's the instruments you can choose from. And I was like, well, I don't know what that is. That one's too big. So I'll choose the violin. So so I started off on violin when I was in third grade.
Same, by the way.
Yeah.
Violin, third grade. Yep.
Whoa, that's awesome. See, that's cool. That's awesome. That's how we're doing this. So yeah, so I started off with the school's orchestra program. I continued playing violin until now. It's still, I consider it to be one of my main instruments. And so I grew up, you know, doing the whole classical music thing. So I was in that classical music world, but then in like middle school is when I also discovered rock and like alternative rock and indie and just really got into that as well. And so then I started playing electric guitar and I had been in, you know, it was like a white suburb of Philly. And so I was in that world, you know, and then it got to a point in college where it was kind of like, wait, how is it that I'm from Mexico, but I know very little really about the music of where I'm from? And there was a mariachi group on campus, so I joined that on violin and started singing in Spanish for the first time, which I didn't even like to sing back then. I hated singing for a while. But then I started singing, joining that group. I started just learning a lot more about like just the musics that exist outside of like the US and Eurocentric scope of things. And that's when son jarocho came into my life through a band called Las Cafeteras that do kind of like a Chicano version of son jarocho. It's not even like, mm-hmm. you know, traditional son jarocho, but I loved what they were doing and especially them being like activists and organizers. So I loved their message, but then also I was like, I want to learn more about the traditional, the root that comes from. And so that's when I started going to workshops. I ended up actually doing my thesis on son jarocho and on how tradition adapts and how groups like Las Cafeteras are actually continuing that history of resistance from the colonial era to now. And so I me enamoré de eso. I just fell in love with that tradition. And here I am still. Now I've been doing leading community music workshops in Philly for about 7 years now of Son Jarocho. And then I started Interminable also about like 6 years ago now.
When you talked about this idea of shifting the original lyrics to something new, I think about renacer. I think about rebirthing, right? And like allowing the music to rebirth, to transform us.
Yeah.
And so I guess there's sort of two questions in there for me. And one is about the deeper meaning of your album, Rebirth Renacer, but also what is the deeper intention behind Interminable's music? Like, what are you hoping to do, feel, experience, give with that work?
I feel like this project has taught me a lot as it's gone. A lot of these songs, like I kind of had a certain intention in mind, and then I'll write these songs, and then as we sing them and as the years pass, it actually has taught me where it's going. So one of them is even in the name, Interminable, right? Originally, I just wanted a word that was the same in both English and Spanish, and then also something that just felt like it tapped into that creative energy, etc. And so we chose that name, and because we had to choose it like very last minute. Like we were about to play a show and we didn't have a name. And so I was just like last minute coming up, like brainstorming with some folks at a Son Jarocho workshop, and we came up with that. And it stuck. And I love it because it's taught me that really a kind of core message or a core purpose or meaning that we're going toward is to tap into that endless nature we have, right? To tap into the fact that when we tap into our creativity, we inspire those around us. And that creates a never-ending cycle of inspiration and of creativity and of rebirth then, mm-hmm. right? As individuals, as communities. And so I always say, you know, with Interminable, it's even if you only come to one of our shows, but at that one show, I don't know, that one of the songs inspires you to do something, or maybe you meet someone at that show and then you end up collaborating with them down the line. And then that ends up inspiring someone else. That ends up inspiring someone else, et cetera, et cetera. That to me is so beautiful. It's so powerful. And that's also why for the name of the album is Rebirth Renacer. It's that same idea. It's that ability that we have. And in that, I'm including anyone. I think we all have that creative energy inside us.
Absolutely. So, we're born with it. It's our human creative gift. That's what we were born with as humans, is this power to create.
Exactly. So, you know, obviously it manifests in different ways in different people, but I think we all have that ability to imagine new ways of being. And I know art, like, of course we have this ideal of like, art will change the world. You know, I don't think it's sure, like, what would it be incredible if, like, with one song we could completely, like, I don't know, undo white supremacy, et cetera, whatever. Like, yeah, that'd be incredible. Will it? Probably not. But what it can do is inspire one person, several people, a group of people, a community. And now we're thinking about things differently. Now we're inspired. That already there is, that's it. That's everything.
You know, I often get the question, what kind of impact have you seen? You know, what kind of impact have you seen with your work? So I guess I'm curious, is there anything that you've witnessed so far, like any clues that you've had on the impact of your music?
Yeah, it's interesting. Like you say, sometimes there's things that we know, sometimes there's things we don't. It's same with me. Once in a while, we'll get messages from people just being like, oh, I see what you're doing. I really like it. And I was talking about that actually recently at Soulfire, another place that I think is one of those evidences in and of themselves, right? Of like, when we're meeting incredible people like that and incredible projects like that, that to me already is evidence that is working, that it's leading us towards each other and on the right path. And I met a musician there, Reina Fabiola, who is part of Savila and Reina Tropical and a bunch of projects. And I was like, hey, I really appreciate your music. Like, it's really inspiring. And she was like, oh, that's cool. Like, I never know, like, yeah, who, like, who's listening or what. And I'm like, no, yeah, I'm there. I'm listening. I think a lot of people are. And we talked about that, how sometimes I think as artists too, in this current day and age, it can feel so disorienting because everything's so centered on, like, your Spotify Wrapped numbers and, like, all these things that, sure, they can tell you one thing, but sometimes there's these things like that that just go beyond, you know, how many likes you get or something that yeah. it can't tell you. And where the algorithm, I do think, is actually kind of set up against us, where it's like, it's hard to get our things out sometimes. I see that in the project. And sometimes I'm like, oh, I don't think it's really having that much of an impact, or, you know, where it can feel so doubtful. But then we'll go and we'll get out there and we'll do a show. And right away, I see how exciting this is for people and how inspiring it is for people. And I'm like, wait, right, this is, it's the people, that's what it's about, you know, that's what it's right. about. And that's there.
Ximena, thank you so much for being on the Rhythm of Rebellion. I'm so grateful to have this conversation.
Yeah, thank you. And thanks to whoever is listening. I'm wishing you all the best with your creative processes, and I hope this can inspire you as well.
Listen to the full episode of this podcast at therhythmofrebellion.com. Thanks for listening.
That's it. That's our song. Tune back in at this same time next week for another Rhythm of Rebellion profile of performing artists leading social change. And thanks to Taina Asili for this interview and to Moses Nagel for editing and support of this story. And that's our show. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Kaylin McPherson.
And I'm Sina Bazila Hickey. We want to thank all of the volunteers who made today's episode possible. Mark Dunley provided headlines on our first segment. Bria Barthel produced the script production and a segment. Other producers were Eunice Jung. I produced one, and Taina Asili in collaboration with Moses Nagel. This program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community, for the community, and is supported by independent donations. If you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a Sanctuary Sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org.
We want to hear from you. Find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Media Sanctuary, or send us an email to hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Tune in weekdays at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news or stream Sanctuary Radio at mediasanctuary.org. Full episodes and individual stories are available on demand on our website and on your favorite podcast platform. We appreciate you listening, and remember, radio is not dying. It's just growing into the future. Until next time, folks.
Hi, it's Nico, the youngest producer. You've been listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine, featuring news and views from around the New York Capital Region. Listen at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. on Sanctuary Radio, 105.3 FM, Troy, and online at mediasanctuary.org. You can also visit mediasanctuary.org anytime to hear the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on demand or to sign up for our podcast.